Hello, welcome to Greenlit, with me, the voice which belongs to Toby Earle. In each episode of Greenlit, a guest receives the thrilling news their life is to be made into a biopic, and we discuss how that story will be told. Will they star? Which moments won't make it into the adaptation? And will King Kong make an appearance? In this episode, comedian, writer, and actor Rajiv Karia will plot the course of this certain blockbuster. Karia has appeared in BBC Three's Lazy Susan, CBBC's Mallory Towers. He's written for Radio 4's Best Medicine and The Now Show, CBBC's Horrible Histories. He'll be appearing at the Leicester Comedy Festival on February the 17th with his Edinburgh show Gallivant. And he sold his revolutionary snack concept, Toast on Beans, to NASA for a whopping £80. Rajiv Karia, welcome to Greenlit.
Hello, it's a pleasure to be here. Pleasure to be here with you.
We're so pleased that you're here. Particularly, of course, you know, you just secured this amazing deal with NASA, huge life-changing sum of money, £80. How did you spend it, or would you rather not say? You kind of, you know, do you kind of keep that thing personal?
I'm an entrepreneur. I put the money right back into my lab, my beans, toast, and cheese lab. It's in Zurich. Those CERN guys, they're just down the road, big buyers. I mean, we're experimenting with putting the cheese under the beans, that kind of thing. I've said too much.
The thing is, you don't want an £80 idea to be stolen away from you, do you? That's the thing. Like, it's a lot of money and investment in there, and that is a big future. I mean,
that's life changing money if you live in like early Victorian England.
What would your first purchase have been in Victorian England with £80?
Penny farthing.
Would it be pimped? Did they ever pimp bikes? Like, they must have pimped bikes.
I think they pimped the penny farthing by going, okay, let's give this two normal size wheels. I mean, when people probably saw non-penny farthing bicycles for the first time, they were like, oh God, bloody hell. This day and age is nothing sacred. It'll never catch on.
When they suddenly did get normal bicycles, did people suddenly feel like, oh my God, I feel like an idiot to have been riding this?
It does make you wonder, how did they get to big wheel, small wheel first, rather than just two wheels of the same size? Why not two big wheels?
It makes as much sense. Because basically, if you take the penny farthing design and you flip it, you've got a drag racer then, haven't you? With a massive wheel at the back and the small one at the front. And they could have been having like Fast and the Furious style drag races down cobbled streets. I mean, very painful, but...
I'd like to see, it's like a monster truck rally, but it's the custom penny farthing with two enormous wheels, and it's doing a huge jump over a load of regular sized bicycles.
This again feels like an idea you're selling too easily to people.
I mean, I'm the idea man. I just come up with the ideas. I don't get them. I don't put them into action. I don't make any money off them. I just generate them. How's this? A sitcom about four sets of identical twins. And they all work at a burger joint together. And let me tell you, hijinks does ensue. Yeah, it's just free. That's free. Anyone can have that.
I love it. Well, they all got the same name as well.
Between them, they have three different names. So out of eight people, three names.
I mean, it's almost like House of the Dragon or some kind of fantasy, like where you're basically everyone's named the same and you're like, who, what? But I love it.
I presume that was the plot of House of the Dragon. I've not seen it. You know, when you see adverts for it and you go, oh, another workplace bloody sitcom.
I think George R. R. Martin may well be listening and ruining his decision to turn it to have made it into a fantasy epic when he could have just had the burger joint idea.
You shouldn't be allowed to do, if you've done something as successful as what he's done with Game of Thrones, you shouldn't be allowed to keep doing the same type of thing. Like, if you make a really, really successful sci-fi television program, afterwards you should have to, like, make funny vines for 10 years. Because, like, think about the things you could do if you applied your brain to, like, a completely different format. We'd have people doing the most unbelievable crossover we'd ever seen.
This film is going to be sold hard on what it is. Not a workplace comedy necessarily, but we've got a couple of questions to work out first, Rajiv. Is it pronounced biopic or biopic?
I think it like depends on the quality. Like, if everyone agrees that it was pretty vain, you know, the person it's about is still alive and they're an EP and they've had their grubby mitts all over it. That's a biopic. But I think if it's, you know, somebody humble who's been dead for 20 years and it's a very beautiful, moving depiction of their life and struggle, then you've got the other one that you said. It was Biopis, any of them?
Biopis.
Biopis. Yeah.
Biopis.
Well, here we say spend a penny, and in France they say biopis.
So you can have this meeting with these executives to make your biopis?
Biopis, yes.
Biopis. Oh, very French. I get it. Biopis. Yeah. Biopis. I'm trying to work out where the accent goes, but yes, biopis. Where are you going to meet these executives for this discussion on how the film's going to be?
I mean, we're obviously at the Cannes Film Festival, right?
Right. No one's ever said that before. So why Cannes? Why the Croisette?
I guess. So Cannes is this. Have you been? You feel like that? You seem like the kind of guy to have gone.
No, have I been to Cannes? No, I've bought Cannes, but I've never been to Cannes. I've seen Antoine de Caunes on television, but I've never been to Cannes.
Right, so you've had a couple of cans.
Yes.
And then, you know, thrown on Die Hard 2. Nice. Yeah, I guess the thing about it as a film festival, it's much closer than any of the ones in America. Big international, like, big deal. So you have, like, probably big shot Hollywood people, big shot film people from around the world all fly in. But it's not that far away from us. So probably if you've got, say, a fear of flying, but you really want to make it big in films, hop in the car. Through the tunnel, down to Cannes, crash a few executive events, lie, tell them you were in the prequel to Downton Abbey.
Yep.
Tell them, oh, have you guys ever seen The Big Bang Theory? Oh, I was in the original British version of that. And it was called Nerds in the Pantry. And they'll go, yeah, that sounds about right. And you get in there, and then that's how I would do it. Then before you know it, I'm mixing with the high rollers.
Yep. I mean, have you ever gate crashed a party? Are you good at gate crashing parties?
You know, it's something that I think I wish I had done more, but I don't think I have. I'm a wanderer inner. That's what I am.
A gallivanter?
Yeah, I've done a lot of wandering in my time. I'd like to have been more of a gate crasher. I think it's a very cool thing, isn't it? If you met someone who said, like, yeah, I once gate crashed into... Actually, no, I've got a decent wandering in story.
Yeah.
I met the singer from The Strokes in Shoreditch about 4 years ago, just on the street, and I'm about as big a Strokes fan as there is, and got chatting to him, and he was quite friendly, and he put me on the list for the show. He's got another band called The Voids. He put me on the list for that show for that evening. So obviously, greatest day of my life. And he said, oh, yeah, he hands me his phone, stock image background, which I thought was very interesting.
Excuse me?
Yeah, stock image background, just like the iPhone background. That felt like the guy in Inception who was supposed to design the backgrounds had let that one slip, you know, in as he created my dream state life. Anyway, I put down plus two, but then when I got there that night, actually I was with three friends who I ended up with. And so I kind of talked my way through it. I said to them at the door, I was like, oh, I'm on the list and it should be plus three. And they said, oh, you're down as plus two. And I said, no, it should be plus three. And this is, I'd never do this shit. I was really pushing my luck. And then the lady on the door gets her supervisor and the supervisor says, sorry, who put you on the list? And I got to drop the Julian Casablancas, the singer of the band, put me on the list. And then she went, okay, yeah, plus three. And we got in, and my obviously bringing my mates in, like, I'm the king of the world. The show was great. And then afterwards, I was like, right, obviously we have to try and get backstage. Unfortunately, the wristbands that we had did get us in the back room, where we lasted about 4 minutes until an incredibly aggressive New York-type manager came up to us and was like, you boys got to go. And we were like, yep, fair enough. That's fine. Got the story. We'll see you later.
See, the thing is, right, I bet when you went into the gig, having just talked your way into the gig with the extra pal, I'm assuming your skin was just tingling. Like, the whole night was just tingling. Oh, it's like when you're 15 or 16, you get into a pub or a nightclub or get served for the first time. I'm assuming it was that kind of sensation.
Yeah, it was. There's nothing like it.
What was the backstage room like? Can you describe the kind of vibe?
Pretty dingy. Pretty small, dingy-ass room. With the band and a few of their cool-seeming friends. But the thing about the back room, I think anywhere, is it's the desire of the back room rather than anything that's going on in it.
It's the fantasy.
Yeah.
I would have thought though, like, you know, Strokes, Julian Casablancas, the kind of dingy, that dingy CBGB 70s thing, that's kind of what they're after.
Yeah. I think, yeah, I was kind of hoping that I would step there and suddenly I'd be backstage in a cool venue in the East Village in 2002. But Julian's time travel technologies are still in their infancy.
I think, I mean, imagine writing the review of the gig going, look, I really enjoyed the gig. However,
massively disappointed with the passage of time. Going to see a band that was good in the early 2000s and are still good did not make me travel back in time to when I was younger and more hopeful. Two thumbs down.
I like the concept of being massively disappointed with the passage of time, essentially being like a review of life. Like, so how would you review life? Well, just massively disappointed with the passage of time. It's
relentless, isn't it?
It is relentless. But however, exciting news. Your life has been greenlit for a biopic, or if you like, a biopic. But how would your life be told by Hollywood or Bollywood or Nollywood? And what sort of creative control would you exercise in bringing the greatest story you know to the big screen? So big question, Rajiv. What's the film called? What is the biopic called?
I think I've got a real thing for like big, lavish titles that actually end up having very little to do with the plot of the film. Like the film Tyrannosaur, you know, not about dinosaurs.
No.
The film Naked Lunch, there no naked lunch takes place. I think you're allowed to get away with it in like other mediums, like an album, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And you're definitely allowed to get away with it with Edinburgh shows. People give their Edinburgh shows these huge, ridiculous titles, being like, oh, it's a show about this and this and this. And it's just a stand-up comedy show. And I think I'd like to give it a good, ridiculous name that kind of connects to sort of a metaphorical feeling that takes place for about 2 minutes in the middle. So call it something like Star of Track and Field or Astronaut. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Also, Astronaut, though, of course, you sold your concept to NASA for £80.
Yeah. So,
I mean, that is feeling like we're heading towards maybe Astronaut, because it's
sort of a space thing.
A space thing. Are you a star of track and field? Do you have track and field capabilities?
Not at all, but I just quite like it as a phrase.
It's a nice phrase. Have you ever tried the javelin or the hammer or the discus?
I did discus in sports day when I was in year eight. And you know, when like there's sort of six of you out there and you're like, none of us can do this. And then one of you, I still managed to be the underperformer by quite a sight. And you think, oh, great, that's nice. Why couldn't I have just been why couldn't I have just been incredible at that? Not fair, really. I just want to be incredible at one thing. I think everybody does that when they try something new. There's something in the back of their head being like, imagine if I was a prodigy. You go with your mates to do, like, I don't know, Laser Quest. You're like, imagine if I was amazing at this. And then you're obviously either standard crap or really, really bad. And you're like, yeah, obviously. Turns out you only get good at stuff from like effort and practice and natural talent. And I got none of those.
It's very disappointing, isn't it? And particularly things like, as well, when you're that young, you talk about like doing discus, right? It's like such a complicated series of mechanical motions, and you know, you're spinning, you're clutching, release, all that. And it's, you know, to ask like an 8-year-old, all right, do this with like the barest of training, it's only going to surely shatter their self-confidence.
And also, they're going to hurt each other. It's like a really like a frisbee made out of lead. They're just going to be like, if you turn around for 5 minutes, they're going to have their hands flat on the ground and they're going to be smacking each other's hands down. If you don't move your hand away fast enough, you get clammed up with the lead frisbee.
Javelin? Did you ever javelin? Have you tried that?
I think I have javelined once or twice. Yeah, not as satisfying as I thought it would be.
Again, it's not like when you see people do it in the release and it just soars through the air like some kind of like some Greek warrior has just launched it, and it's just.
It's more about the pageantry than anything. I think, you know, the world's greatest javelin player could be doing a variety of other sports, but they do javelin because it looks kind of cool.
I I feel like astronaut, and maybe we're going towards astronaut here. Do you like space?
Let's call it astronaut.
Are you a big fan of space?
I'm pretty interested in space. I like space culture, especially like when you look at like space race movies and stuff from the 60s and like the massive effect that space had on pop music in like from like David Bowie's Space Oddity. There's the Carpenters have that space song, Rocket Man.
Yeah.
There's loads of space stuff from the 70s when they were all like, right, this is the thing we all love.
It does speak to sort of an idealistic period, doesn't it? Like there was this sense that the reaching out into the stars had these unlimited possibilities and what we might discover about ourselves.
Yeah.
How's that gone, do you think? How's that?
Yeah, I think now, you know what it was? Space, like, it peaked too soon. You know, post-World War II, suddenly it's the space race, and everybody loved the space race because it was, like, hopeful, but you could also be xenophobic as well. And I think we know that people in the 50s and 60s, that's what they really wanted. They wanted to be aspirational, you know. They were boomers, the war was over, but they wanted to hate somebody. And so it was like the Russians, right, they'll do. So they hated the Russians, and then, the West won the space race, and then, you know, go to space, 10 years later, go to the moon. And now it's been like 50 years since then. It's just like, oh, I don't know, no real big updates, really.
Massive lack of permanent moon base.
Yeah.
You would have thought by now.
I mean, if we were like workshopping this for like a, you know, the HBO series, you're not going to get to the moon until the end of the third series. And then there's going to be some sort of big bloodbath at the end of the fourth series, the Red Planet wedding.
Yes, and nice.
Then there'll be like, then loads of the cast will leave. So you'll get a whole bunch of new school people, launch the spin-off in the seventh series. That bombs, you bring all of them back. We're talking upwards of 13 unwatchable series.
I mean, that's a great sell to an executive, isn't it? I've got panned out 13 unwatchable series, and I think we can make it happen.
Yeah, we can make it happen, and it could all be yours.
Did you like space as a child?
Yeah, space, planets, and and sort of space travel. I guess, you know, being raised by boomers, obsessed with the space race, kind of stayed with us. It's a great thing to be interested in as a kid. Space and dinosaurs.
The two ends of the spectrum, essentially, aren't they? Low-tech and high-tech. They are great obsessions, natural obsessions. I'm just wondering, if the film's called Astronaut, right, will at any stage it feature you in an astronaut's outfit? Will that be something which happens, or is it just going to be a sense more of, hey, aren't we all astronauts floating through space?
Yeah, you've definitely got that option of astronaut kind of is this lovely dreamy word as well that kind of has to do with chasing your dreams. Like, it's synonymous with chasing your dreams. I want to be an astronaut. I think we could definitely get away with a sort of folksy Napoleon Dynamite eagle versus shark type scene where I'm in like a homemade astronaut outfit.
Yep.
Something like that. Yeah, definitely. We're putting that in now.
Eagle versus
shark. I've fed it up to the execs in my brain and they love it.
They love it.
It's a deal. Okay. It's a deal breaker.
Lo-fi astronaut outfit. Do you know what's another good word? Cosmonaut's a good word, isn't it?
But that cosmonaut's a great word. Cosmonaut was also on my list.
Was it?
Yeah,
I love cosmonaut.
Cosmonaut.
It's just a nice word. Cosmonaut is just a nice space. It's a nice word. Also,
because it's got that SM.
Yes.
That SM next to it, which is nice.
Because it's slightly alien quality to it as well. Like cosmonaut. Yeah. Like, where are those guys going? We're going to Astros and they're going to Cosmos? This is crazy.
That's true. Because obviously there was a difference between Russian space and US space. American space is all golf and flags and stuff, and obviously Russian space is all queuing for bread on the moon. If movies have taught me anything about what life is like in Russia, is they're always bloody queuing for bread. Thank God I live in hipster East London, where we queue for bread all the time.
If that's the name of the film, Astronaut is the name of the film. What's the opening scene? How does Astronaut open? Do we open in space or do we open much closer to the ground?
I was thinking about what my favorite opening scenes entail. And I think that, like, I'm very much over. Okay, the bottom is an opening scene that's cryptic or telling you about something that happened 30 years ago or worse, 30 years in the future. Don't want that anymore. I want the story to start where it starts. Also, I don't think I want too much like scenery without seeing a protagonist. Like often, you know, these open with like lots of shots of things and like, okay, oh, I guess we're in the deep south. Here's this big tracking shot of the bayou or whatever. No, I was thinking I want it moving. Trainspotting got it right. Trainspotting drums kick in for Lust for Life, and then boom, we're just running down the street. And I think it should be as quick as that. I think I want it to start with running. You know what? We'll borrow from the star of Track and Field. It'll be the sound of running, and it's me running, and I've got a discus in my hand. And it's me as a sort of 12, 13-year-old, and it's at school. And obviously, we're not dressed in what's normal school PE kits look like. It's the Wes Anderson filter is on. So we're in all kind of like a beautifully color-coded vests and shorts. All the boys have side partings, even though when I went to school, nobody had a parting. The bully's lunch if you had a parting. But yeah, they all look very Wes Anderson-y. And yeah, instead of Lust for Life, keep on the Wes Anderson route, and it'll be Lust for Life, but it won't be the Iggy version. It'll be like maybe by that Brazilian singer who did all the Wes Anderson music. So it'll
Is it
be like a
Sue
Portuguese version.
Is it?
Yeah, Portuguese version of Lust for Life.
Yeah, Portuguese Lust for Life.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a winner. Is it school sports day? You're running with a discus in your hand?
Well, that's what we're gonna learn. At the start, it's just running. I think that's what Trainspotting
Just
got
running.
right. It's just running, and then you give them the info as it goes. People like running. People like watching footage of people running.
The Olympics have proven to be so enduring, I guess. They
Yeah,
just people just love it, don't they?
this is gonna be the first film commissioned for BBC Sport. It's going to be the first scripted coming of age film for BBC Sport.
This is amazing. I had no idea we were going to go this way.
You know what? If BBC Sport don't want it, we'll sell it to Strava.
Okay, Strava will buy it,
Yeah.
I'm sure. It's another £80 idea, isn't it? Strava streaming platform.
I only accept £80, no more, no less.
You say like opening scenes which are cryptic. Is there one that you can think of that kind of like always annoys you when you see it or when you think about it, or it's like stuck with you as being something that's just kind of frustrating because it's either overly artsy or overly cryptic and doesn't pay off?
I think there are so many that it's hard to narrow down on one. Like when you watch a movie where it just starts at the beginning and it's moving, you do kind of just go, why don't they all do this? Why don't they just get going? And then we'll just figure it out as it goes. But instead it's like, oh, we'll take it nice and slow, ease you in. I'm like, nah, shave all this off. Get this movie down to a nice 87 minutes.
87 minutes. Oh, you're in dreamland territory now.
Oh yeah.
There was that film as well, Run Lola Run. Do you remember that?
Oh, is that the one that was told in three parts?
Yeah. Three different outcomes to her. She's literally running for, is it her boyfriend's life? She's trying to drop
Something like
something
that.
into it.
So I have not seen that, but I have seen Go, which is in the same format.
Right.
And Go is excellent. Have you seen Go?
That's the one with the multiple story strands with Katie Holmes and
Yeah.
Timothy
So,
Oliphant with some of the best
yeah.
hair you've ever seen. His
Go is
hair in
the
that.
most late 90s movie ever made.
It
Like
is.
you can keep your 10 Things I Hate About You. You can keep your like get over it. You whatever. It's so late 90s, and it's that thing of it shows you the same night over the perspective of three different characters.
Yep.
That is a movie that gets going immediately.
Yeah. Also, banging, I'm sure Steal My Sunshine by Len was part of the soundtrack, I
It
think.
was mandatory in 1999. You made anything. Steal My Sunshine by Len was getting in.
It's a track I still very much enjoy. Oh, yes, go is a good template. But I'm wondering, you're saying about running, is everyone just running through the film? Or is everyone just running constantly?
That could be a fun motif, and that'd be a fun like obviously because I've got my own grubby mitts all over my own biopiece.
Quite
I'm
right.
allowed to like make myself look good
Yes,
because that's a quite common thing. So I wasn't a very athletic child, so maybe I'll make myself in the film. Oh, I'm a very gifted runner, but everyone really resents me for it. And I think yeah. So yeah, we'll have a theme of running. So now we've got themes of running, themes of space.
this is so nice.
Nice.
I like the idea as well. If you are a really talented runner, what about being a really talented discus thrower? And as you're running laps, as you come up to the discus zone, you just gracefully spin, release, and then carry on running, and you've thrown the discus at the same time, and you're a champ at both.
Yeah, I'm running on the only track that has ever had a corner. And so when I get to the corner, I throw the discus, and it's great for me as well, because I'm losing a bit of the weight of the discus means that I'll get my speed efficiency up for the next section.
Now, you mentioned there you're starting off with a 12, 13-year-old. Next question, though. Who'd be cast in the lead? I'm assuming no child actor. I'm assuming that's just going to be played by some young child actor, and then we'll see an older version of Rajiv.
That'll be just played by some poor child with a pushy parent. And obviously I'll be on set and I won't learn the kid's name. I think if I was thinking about who, it'd have to be somebody British, I think.
Okay.
There's so much like brilliant British talent who are in my like age window who I would cast.
Yeah.
I mean, Dev Patel's always been around and he's kind of got same hair as me and he's doing good stuff. But I don't, he's even, we're from like near each other as well. But I don't know, I don't think he'd do it justice.
Ooh.
He's too believable.
As you?
He's too good at conveying truth. I would need someone more wry. I think I'd quite like to see, I'd like to bend the rules a bit, perhaps bend the rules of the gender and the race. I mean, I'd like to cast Will Poulter.
Ooh, wasn't expecting that.
Will Poulter is a guy who started out as like, everyone's like, here we go. He's going to be the next big British goofball. Was in things like Son of Rambo School of Comedy, where he did like such an amazing performance as like an up-and-coming sketch guy. Was like such a brilliant face comedian. Could pull the weirdest faces. And I don't think any of us expected to turn out as handsome as he has. And now he's kind of like this sort of leading man with a thick neck and a really like, take notice brow. And I feel like he could do a lot of stuff, and I'd like to challenge him and be like, right, you're gonna play me, we're just not gonna address it, we're not gonna address the difference of race, and then if people ask about it, we'll just say, oh no, you're mistaken.
Which I'm assuming the junior version of you would have the same heritage.
And then
Will Poulter comes along.
Will Poulter plays me. And that's it. And it's just never addressed. Yeah. And also, you know what? Scratch that. Scrap the child who I didn't learn the name of. He's fired. We just have Will Poulter, you know, 30-year-old adult Will Poulter playing me at all stages of my life. So in that scene, he's just like, he's got 3 feet on the rest of the kids, but he's playing a 10-year-old.
I think it works. I think stylistically.
Man could do it.
Yeah. And you know, he's such an interesting actor. It's such an interesting choice as well, because you're right. He does. He you forget he started out Son of Rambo, which 20 odd years ago, right? Like it was a long time. And he did that, does quite serious films like Detroit. He made that film.
Yeah.
I saw him in a horror film recently alongside Domhnall Gleeson, set in a big spooky house where he played someone who'd had quite badly disfigured during the war. And he was terrific. He's very versatile, isn't he?
Very versatile. And I want to take advantage of that.
I Will Poulter. Now, speaking of versatility, you might have mentioned this already. Coming of age, a coming of age movie. So what genre would the film be and why? And what sort of budget are we looking at? Are we looking at a coming of age comedy, action thriller?
I think I like the sort of simple backdrop of coming of age because it kind of is this great catch-all for movies where you don't necessarily, where you maybe want to amble a bit rather than just get straight to a fast-moving plot that needs to be solved. Ambling in films is increasingly becoming a lost art, and I think it's a lot of fun. I think it's especially when you're analyzing films years later, people go, "Oh yeah, remember there's that weird scene in the middle where they just go to that diner and it's a sort of nice little bit of dialogue that isn't in a rush to go somewhere." So I think coming of age films are great for that. I think comedy, I think they definitely want like a funny aspect to it, because I think if you're not making something funny, it has to be somewhat dramatic.
Yeah.
And I don't really feel the need to do that. I don't think there's any fake struggle in my life. Sure, I didn't make it as an astronaut, but most people don't. So
the dropout numbers on the program that you were part of are very high.
Yeah, I know. Coming of age, out of the movies that I've seen that have sort of spoken to me the most, they're always sort of coming of age films. In fact, that's probably true for everybody. I'd love to know who was watching like Collateral and thought, man, he just liked me for real. But yeah, those are the ones that really stick with you, especially from the last few years. Like there's like Lady Bird and Booksmart to an extent.
Yeah. Eighth Grade. Have you seen Eighth Grade?
Eighth Grade, Jesus, Eighth Grade. They should have put like a warning at the start of that, being like, this movie's gonna wake up feelings in you that lay long dormant. Sadness that managed to erase itself from your brain.
That film is spectacular in so many ways. The sequence, Orinoco Flow, Enya social media sequence, is just one of the funniest, saddest, most brilliant bits of film I've seen in such a long time. And I loved how lonely it just feels. There's so much loneliness in that film.
Yeah, it's almost a bit like it's that school of filmmaking, obviously on the other side of the spectrum, where like if you've seen Mother, the Darren Aronofsky film, he's like, right, what? How do I can make an audience really, really on the edge just by doing tiny little social faux pas throughout?
Mm.
You know, she's like that itching feeling of people are in her house and she doesn't seem to know who any of them are, and how that unsettling that would be. And Eighth Grade kind of does the same on the other end of the spectrum, where it's just like the very subtle pain of being that age and trying to fit in.
Was there a film that you saw when you were coming of age, that was a coming of age film, that made you think, maybe not Collateral, but made you think like, oh God, yeah, I, oh man, this is, I feel it. I mean, this is me. Was there a movie that did
Collateral
that?
Collateral killed any dreams I had of wanting to be a taxi driver. You know, broke my heart. And a contract killer for that matter. Yeah, I think Ferris Bueller was the one that sticks with me the most.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it kind of ages in funny ways, but I think it's if you see it when you're young enough to really get excited by it, it really hits hard. And I think it's just kind of, regardless of the other things about it, it's about kind of being in the moment as much as you can.
Mm.
You know, because the whole thing's supposed to take place over effectively 8 hours.
Mm.
But when you're that age, days can feel that long. You know,
yep.
They can feel like an amazing loads of things. That's kind of what I know. That's what David Wayne said about Wet Hot American Summer. The reason why so much happens in that film over the course of what's supposed to be a day is he said it was supposed to reflect what it felt like when you were that age.
Yeah.
And a day, a million things happened in a day. And I think Ferris Bueller conveys that.
I've never really thought until you mentioned there about how it's sort of about being in the moment. About how it's just doing it, doing something, you know, whatever, like whatever it is, just doing it. I never really thought about it in that respect, because I'd always thought of Ferris as someone who's actually quite meticulous, maybe, and like he's not planned, but like he's quite, you know, he's certain what he does is going to pay off, as opposed to being blasé about what if it doesn't.
Yeah, he's kind of, I think with Ferris is that's probably what he really is, but the showman that he is a different man. So behind the scenes, he's calculating it all up. He's making sure the plans are right. But in front of someone like Cameron, who wants to say no to everything, he's the most cocky, confident man in the world. Mm. And that's kind of bleeds into everyone else in this town who knows who he is. And I think it's good to kind of have a bit of that inside you. So good to have a bit of confidence, good to have a bit of Ferris and Cameron.
Yeah.
Bit of Ferris to be like, let's go for it. Come on, let's go for it. What's the worst that could happen? And Cameron going, no, we could get arrested, and making a sensible decision that exists somewhere in the middle.
Do you think Ferris Bueller grew up to be a happy man, or do you think he peaked too soon? I mean, look at his life, his girlfriend, you know, the partner he had. Cameron had long way to go in terms of growing.
I think part of that movie is not thinking too much about what happens to Ferris, because it's never really implied whether he's like a bad guy or not, but like, if he were to want to keep up that lifestyle, he'd have to turn into some sort of maybe an investment banker, or maybe like a landlord, right? He'd want to be getting rich off other people's work. And that all gets quite bleak when you think about it.
Ferris Bueller's Tenant's Day Off. That just doesn't have the same vibe, does it? That's the thing. He would grow up to be probably quite an unpleasant, untrustworthy
I mean, think about it. He's got to have finance to pay for all that kind of lifestyle.
Yeah.
He's going to get some sort of corporate job to pay the bills.
It's almost incredible that no one at any stage has announced we're going to do a Ferris Bueller, however many years on, film or series or whatever. Like, you know, sort of streaming platform money hasn't been thrown at Broderick and Ruck.
But I think you could also say that hasn't been done for The Breakfast Club, that hasn't been done for basically any of the John Hughes stuff. I think John Hughes's fortress is very well protected, because he kind of retired And then he died young.
Mm.
And I think he made a fortune. And I think whoever's looking after his estate has gotten that under lock and key. I mean, it's not like it ha- I mean, they did a Ferris Bueller TV series after the show.
Did they?
Spin-offs have been tried. Yeah. And I think if people watched it, I think I feel like I read somewhere that Jennifer Aniston was in it. But in general, you don't have to. I mean, like, it's the golden rule of reboots. You can just make something new. And they make something new in the vein of Ferris Bueller or The Breakfast Club every year, you know. They'd probably do it 10 times. Yeah. And it probably really appeals to a new generation, and that's important.
Before we move on, I think I read somewhere, I'm pretty sure I read someone on social media, someone posited this incredible story that Ferris Bueller's Day Off is essentially Succession canon. And what you have there is like, it's almost like Cameron's dad is Logan Roy and he loves his Ferraris more. You know what I mean? Like there's that
yeah.
thing that could be like that character when he was younger.
Oh, okay.
That could be Connor Roy.
Yeah, he's playing Connor.
Yeah.
Okay, that's very interesting.
Which I really like that concept.
Perfectly. And then that means Ferris maybe plays, I forget his name now, the guy who Kendall is going to try and take over the company with in series one. His
yes.
kind of very cool and snappy friend.
I can't quite remember his name, but yes, the guy, yeah, who ends up outmaneuvering him. But
yeah. Yeah. He has a he calls Kendall a pusillanimous piece of fool's gold, which I absolutely adored. And then there's another scene where you see him and he's just sat there listening to someone and he's smelling a little bit of lavender under his nose.
I mean, he's a great character. He's a great character. Yeah. Coolly played. But I'm sure Will Poulter will be playing you even in an even more cool way.
Yeah, I think Will Poulter's got that kind of range to do the kind of antsy, like angst-filled teenager who doesn't think, you know, like any teenager should be portrayed as a little uncertain or whatever. But he's got, you know, great comedy chops as well to be able to bring real life to it and would be able to sort of bring some dramatic push. And we'd be able to, you know, as the film builds up and I've got to take a leap of faith, he'd be able to deliver that too.
I'm assuming you didn't take a day off. I'm assuming the school didn't rally to your needs and said you have a liver transplant, so or kidney transplant or pancreas transplant, which I forget exactly what it was in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. But in Astronaut, Rajiv, which parts of your life would definitely have to be in there and why? You mentioned earlier you haven't had to struggle. Is that a thing? You haven't, do you not feel like you've had a struggle in your life as you were growing up, as you were becoming a comedian?
I think anybody who's ever appeared on a podcast hasn't struggled. Yeah, I'm gonna say it. That might be a far too all-encompassing thing to say. But if anybody's out there and they have struggled and then they want to come and find me, do it. I'm online. Come find me. I've got that sweet NASA money. By that I just mean like I think I've had a pretty regular life, and so I'd want it to be about growing up as opposed to overcoming something, which I guess a lot of movies are about. I think it would definitely have lots of, like, I feel like I spent so many days as a teenager in the same parks doing, you know, just killing time, whatever. I think there'd be lots of that, lots of like kind of the kind of conversations that if you have at 15 are the coolest conversations ever. But if you ever overhear someone in a bar who's like 25 trying to have a conversation like that, you're just like, get out with that incredibly cringe navel gazy kind of thing.
What are we talking about? Navel gaze? What sort of navel gazy stuff are we talking about here? What are we talking about? Are we talking about like COD philosophy?
Yeah, that kind of thing. Just sort of overhearing someone trying to tell someone about Plato's cave, or trying to impress someone with being like, isn't it mad to think that we don't see the same colors? Yeah, well, we might not. I wish the color I'm seeing is you right now. Basically just like filler for guys to make a move on girls. That kind of stuff. There'll be lots of that, lots of like awkward like dialogue that teenage boys have with teenage girls. And I think I'd love to sort of incorporate getting into uni. Because I didn't think I would. I definitely, it was like a bit of a long shot. But I think going to the uni I went to, I kind of changed the trajectory of my life, because it kind of got me into, by the time I got to uni, I kind of lost interest in my course quite quickly and then started doing sketch comedy, and it kind of put me on a whole different path. And I think, yeah, if I'd gone to a different uni and studied something quite interesting, I probably would have gone kind of, I'd have nothing to break away from.
Which university did you go to, and what were you meant to read?
I went to Bristol and I did law, and people don't tell you, law is really boring. And then I found out there was a sketch comedy society, and I was like, "Well, there seems to be a lot of money in sketch comedy." Think about it. It was the year 2011. We were coming off the backs of the Peter Serafinowicz show and Mitchell and Webb, and I thought I could be a sketch comedy millionaire.
Golden era.
Yeah.
Now, what year student were you when you sort of when law started to take a bit of a back seat? What was the were you first, second, or
I think it was probably first year, yeah.
first
Got a
year? Quite
board.
early. You hadn't even
Yeah.
hit. From what I remember, everyone would say complain about land law, how boring land law was, I think, which was
Yeah.
second year. So it's first year. Bristol has an incredibly rich comic history, or in terms of
Yeah.
the comedians it's produced. Does it trumpet that at university, or was that kind of why you
Well,
wanted
it
to go
didn't
there? Or
really at the time because a lot of them had just left. So I kind of went to this society, which there weren't many people at. And I think now there's probably more of a following. I think it might have even pushed itself into the territory that like universities like Cambridge have or Harvard, or where people will go to them in pursuit of comedy.
yeah.
They don't go to, they're like, oh, I'm going there to do comedy. The degree is by the by or whatever. And so it might have got to that. For me, it was just like a really fun, at the time, it was just a fun place to do sketches. But the best way to get in, it's such a joy to get into comedy by doing it in a group. And that's what I got to do. So it was good fun. So I think it's a nice round off edge to that, the sense of like getting into uni. You know, that feels like a good end of the film. That's kind of like your Lady Bird. She wants to get into college. She wants to go off to college. Toy Story 3, he goes off to college. Nice
All the
natural
toys
end.
go in the incinerator. That's the best bit. That's the happy end. Yeah,
Exactly. Yeah.
that thing. How did you find the sketch comedy group? What was the way of
I've
getting
always
in?
been a big extracurricular person. Extracurricular hobbies, you name it, all of them. A jazz band at school. If you've ever been in a jazz band, but all you do is
No.
you sit there and play the first three notes and then you just do nothing.
So you can do the soundtrack
Yeah. It'll be awful though, because it's just the first
as well.
three notes and then nothing. Yeah. So many extracurriculars and hobbies throughout school, as any dweeby kid should. You know, a couple of years of taekwondo, tuba, piano. Oh God. And then yeah, and I carried on doing it at uni really, because you get to uni and then they've got to go to the freshers' fair. And you're like, oh my God, am I about to join Ultimate Frisbee? Or maybe I'll become a masseuse or swing dancing. You just try it all.
And then, yeah, and so you join this comedy group, and what? And then you just what? You all sat together and brainstormed ideas to put on shows. What was that
Yeah,
the?
you just kind of like improvised and then did sketches, then did sketch shows, and that sort of took it to Edinburgh, really.
Can you remember the first thing you wrote or performed? Is there something that you can?
Yeah, I remember writing, co-writing a sort of parody of like a Neil deGrasse Tyson or Carl Sagan, where it was like three of us talking out as if we were like mysteries of the universe type
Back to Ask
science
him.
guys.
Yeah.
And one of my lines, and I said some sort of weird space fact, and then I compared it to something else, and then I went, coincidence? Yes. Was very fun. Very kind of student sketch comedy. There's probably been hundreds and thousands of student sketch comedies around, comedy groups around the world, but I guarantee between all thousands of them, there are about 10 different sketches.
Can you name two of the sketches which are always in student comedy?
Something to do with I may be going, I'm just going outside, I may be sometime. Who
Right.
was that?
Captain Oates.
Captain Oates. Okay. Yeah, I went to Edinburgh. The first year I went to Edinburgh, and I saw three different sketch groups who had a sketch about that. And they
Too
were
soon,
all
guys.
funny.
Too soon.
Yeah, they were all very funny. But it's because being in a sketch comedy society usually means you go to a red brick university, which means you're a posh knobhead. And so, yeah, that was a type. And then it always, yeah, something to do with Jesus, I think. Something biblical as well. I think when I was at uni, they did, and this sounds cheesy, but it was actually excellent. The Last Supper, Come Dine with Me. That
That
kind of
is
thing.
good. To be fair, that's a very nice touch. What was it? You performed your show at Edinburgh this last year. You're going to be going to Leicester Comedy Festival in February with it. how many years have you been going to Edinburgh, and like how have you changed? And
I mean, I first went as a student, so like in 2012. So I kind of had this 10-year gap where, well, not gap, but I started my first visit was 10 years ago when I was just doing a student sketch show with some friends. And then this year went for it with the debut stand-up hour. I've sort of, yeah, been about 6 or 7 years as a performer, sort of sketch shows and then stand-up comedy double handers and stand-up comedy work in progress. And this year I was doing the, I mean, it's the most fun in the world. I don't really, and I always think that there should be more films set at the Edinburgh Festival, because like there's a film called Festival from the 2000s, which has got Stephen Mangan in it and stuff. But in general, when you think about the amount of people that make films in this country, they all probably went to Edinburgh at least once, or probably a bunch of times, probably had a bunch of their most formative experiences there, yet nobody makes films about it.
is that because they are so exhausted by it, they just cannot possibly give themselves any more time there, that or mentally or physically?
And maybe they think the average audience goer doesn't care. It's like when a famous comedian gets their own sitcom and they're like, yeah, I know the main character will be an actor. It's just like, why? They'll be a writer. And it's just like, think a bit harder, mate.
How did you find your first Edinburgh hour, like your first sort of big hour? How was that?
I mean, it was such a great time. I mean, going to Edinburgh, anyone who's ever done it will tell you that, you know, it's a baptism of fire, and it's like scary and it's costly and incredibly stressful it can be. But and it wasn't that for me, so I was sort of counting my blessings every day. I was happy with the show. It was challenging to get there, but I feel like it came out quite well. The audiences were really like generous and kind and kept turning out, and I was really happy with my venue and stuff. So I just thought, you know what? Not every year is going to be like this. And, you know, plenty of people are probably out there thinking, oh, I wish I had half as many people as you, half as many days. So I thought, you know what? Count myself lucky on this one. Chalk it up, put it in the bank. That'll do nicely. Keep a couple of posters. And so if years later, when I've given this all up, at least I have a little poster and I'll go, yeah, that's right. 4 stars that got from one reviewer.
You can have it on the wall of your law firm when you start your law firm after the comedy career.
Exactly. When I sort of finally yield and become an astronaut.
That's also, I mean, you can have it on this inside of the space shuttle then when you're
Yeah.
flying up again.
On
Four
the windscreen.
stars. Yeah, on the wind. Well, you go, it's very hard to see when you're driving though where you're going to go if you have it on the
It's fine. There's
windscreen.
nothing to crash into. It's space.
That's true. That's true.
But why do they even have windscreens?
They do, didn't they? Had them on the shuttle, didn't they? They had them on the shuttle.
Yeah.
They must have windscreen. Everyone wants a view.
Yeah, they
What's the point
do.
of going
I
into
guess
space?
so. Yeah. Feels like a bit of a human thing to be like, yeah, we've got to put a windscreen on. It's like, why?
I think, yeah, they do. I would want a windscreen. I mean, some of the ones on space, you know, in like sci-fi, they're too big. Too big.
Yeah.
You're like, come on, guys. The glazer's never going to get that on. You're having all your time at the Edinburgh Festival and university. But what moments would you want on the cutting room floor in Astronaut? What isn't going in the film and why?
I'd like to think that there's a sort of incredibly out of place dance medley that goes in from when I'm like a teenager or something, you know, dancing through the streets, loads of background extras, that kind of stuff. Really, probably the most expensive part of production, you know, really stressful having to bring in choreographers, stunt actors, pyrotechnics, all that kind of stuff, and the director's insisting on it. He's saying it's the linchpin of the film, and you know that has taken weeks, and then that just in the last minute, I sort of look at it and go, nah, chuck it in the bin, and
Would
then
you, was there a part of your life you would have as a dance medley that would then be ultimately cut from the film? Is there a period of your life or an event that could be characterized by dance that then wouldn't make it in?
I learned to juggle when I was 15. Maybe, yeah. Yeah, that was a pretty big day. It would just be that it finally learns to juggle. Juggling discus.
Juggling discus.
Yeah.
Why did you learn to juggle in a day? What was it? Was it a summer holiday or something? You were bored, you just wanted something to do.
Bored, yeah. It's like, kind of, yeah, let's see if I can learn to do this. I mean, I remember it took me like a good better part of a day, and then I spoke to a friend and he was like, yeah, it took me about 20 minutes. And I was like, oh, I'm useless.
Come on.
Yeah, I think dance medley, something that's also, I'd really love to cut something that's quite sort of too essential to cut. Like, you know, when you watch a film and you're like, something is missing here because I'm going. I get what's happened here, but I've had to connect some dots here. And I don't think I was. I shouldn't be expected to do that. Pull
Do you
out a
remember?
tent pole just to keep people guessing and keep the critics going. Oh, acting like it's deliberate. Be like, it's not. Analysis is bullshit.
Have you ever seen a film that you have genuinely not understood because something like that has happened, or like it's, or you've seen a film that's been made and like there's something wrong with it?
David O. Russell's Joy had like 10 or something moments where I was like, what? When was that established? Who's that? A lot of that. A lot.
Do you remember? Did you ever see Death Proof, the
No.
Tarantino film? So that's part of the Grindhouse, like 3 hour thing. Robert Rodriguez had Planet Terror. Then there was a whole load of fake adverts, including Christopher Nicolas Cage's Fu Manchu, which is quite the sight. And then Death Proof, which is Tarantino's film with Kurt Russell as a murderous stunt driver. There is a bit in that where they deliberately have a missing reel, like it literally is like a missing that kind of goes. And then it cuts back in, and like things have progressed since obviously the last thing, which was quite kind of funny. I mean, it obviously saves writing time, I suppose, but
Yeah, it feels a bit of a Simpsons joke
that's basically what it is.
let out of the writer's room. I think I'd want it to be more subtle than that. I think something that goes on the cutting room floor, because so often when you're editing something, you actually there are bits you want to cut, but you're like, oh, that's load bearing. I can't. I like to think that when I get to my own project and it's about my life, I'm in charge, that I can go, yeah. If I don't want it to make sense, it's not going to make sense. And the sound of me smashing a glass against the wall.
Because if, hey, it's life, right? And does life make sense? Does it?
No.
Exactly. That's the question.
Does
But then.
yeah, I say it's life. Does life make sense? And then I'm just running in circles, mad about like,
Yeah,
does it? Does it? I presume that's what Elton John was doing when he was, giving notes on Rocket Man.
that's almost like Julie Andrews and the Sound of Music on the Hill when she's just spinning around. Just if you were just spinning around going, does life make sense?
Yeah, if you
You'd be
put
in the
that audio
Alps.
on top of Julie Andrews, that scene could be a completely different vibe.
Well, if you just put that into the film, people are like, what's going on now? And there's no explanation, just move on.
To be fair, that movie does take place on the backdrop of like the Nazis taking Europe. She should be a lot more stressed.
I mean, apart from the Sound of Music, which is obviously a huge influence, what are the influences on Astronaut from film or TV or literature or comics or theatre? Are there any other, is there anyone you would love to kind of pay homage to, or is there anything that kind of feeds
I
into it?
think, yeah, really liked Lady Bird, and I really like any kind of teen movie that's set over the course of a day. So Superbad and Booksmart, Wet Hot American Summer, because I think they do get it right in that, like, when you're a teenager, so much can happen in a single day. And I think those would be a very big influence on like kind of trying to pack it in, even though it would take place over a more periods, that it would be more seasonal, kind of maybe taking place over the course of 3 years or something, but kind of packing it in with that energy. I also would love to have like kind of play around with more surreal, creepy scenes that weren't necessarily explained, kind of like maybe in like a broad city or something like that, where you kind of utilize a lot of creative license to kind of make a scene seem darker than kind of maybe make it look in a film how it felt in the moment. So maybe if you've got like a scene with a head teacher shouting at you, the head teacher like turns into a dragon or something. But it's not actually addressed being like, oh, we turned into a dragon. It's more just like, well, that's what it felt like.
Nice. Lots of metaphors and whatnot and
Yeah, I think some sort of sometimes just some. I don't think enough people do weird, unexplained stuff. I want a few. I want, like in Lost, I want like there'll be a scene in the school, and in the background there's just a polar bear going by, and no one really notices it. It's really just for the sort of the forums for people to be like, yeah, there's a polar bear, and he never addressed it. I wonder what he meant by that.
they'd run out of ideas. That's what they
Yeah,
meant.
there you
That they'd run out of
go.
ideas.
Completely.
I mean, talk about not things not making sense. Lost is a very good touchstone in terms of just having adding layers and layers and layers of questions and incidents without ever really explaining anything satisfactorily.
Yeah, completely. And what? And I think there was also a. I mean, if you're patient with Lost, even the most generous viewer kind of would take their share of the blame, going, "Oh yeah, this entire time we were like, yeah, what's the answer? I guess the big one is the smoke monster. What is that?" And then at the end, they went, "It's a monster." And then we went, "Oh yeah, that was always an option. I'm sorry for demanding a scientific explanation for what is obviously just a monster."
I think as well, you know, I'm sure I read the writers, I mean, in the middle of series one, probably even after the first two episodes, going, no, they're not dead. And then, you know, however many years later down the line, they're like, oh yeah, they're dead. They're dead. They're like, they are dead. They are.
Well, yeah, they kind of meet up in purgatory, right? There's definitely a line in the final episode which tries to address that thing where it goes, "So we're all dead." It goes, no, we're not dead. This is different. This is different to that thing that everyone thought it was. Different. We're dead now, but we're all meeting up in heaven. We're having a big old heaven barbecue. But that stuff on the island really happened. And it's like, what about the bear? And then cut to black.
Yeah. Oh, I like more visual stuff. Yeah, more unexplained visual stuff.
Yeah, I think everybody complains about the Lost formula of being like, they were just opening doors here, there, everywhere. Nobody thinks about how fun it would be to be in that writer's room. Every creative project is always like, oh, but we need to resolve that. It's all about resolving it. Let's have a little fun. It's my film. Let's open a bunch of doors. Let's have characters that never come back, set up plots that never go anywhere. So you got like a, maybe I've got like a wisecracking best friend and he's got issues at home and one day he says, oh, you know what, screw this, I'm going to go. And he gets on a bus and we're thinking, oh, we'll hear from him later, but just never hear from him again.
Never comes back. Never. Yeah. A bank heist, you know, I love bank heists. A bank heist in the film that you're planning and then you go, okay, anyway, I've just got to do this now. And then it happens. Or does it happen? I don't know. Nobody knows.
Maybe that's where the run is too. There's like a second run. There's a run and I'm running and it's just like really like upbeat. But then you realize that there's like a armed police chasing after me.
Yeah.
And I'm like, ha, 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 ha. I've got like a bag of cash. And you think, like, oh, maybe he's like a gentleman thief. But then you see me like push over an old lady and grab her handbag.
And you've got all the accoutrements of a gentleman thief, you know, the hat, the moustache. You know, all that kind of... Maybe you're in a dinner jacket, even white tie. Yeah.
Dinner jacket and gold hot pants.
Oh, this is going on the poster. This is dinner jacket and gold hot pants. Right, well, I mean, this brings me beautifully to the next question. If the critics love it or hate it, how would that affect you and your next project? But how can the critics hate you or Will Poulter in a dinner jacket and gold hot pants? How is that possible?
Exactly. I mean, I think I've picked well with Will Poulter because his films are all very successful. So I think you'd have a lot of chin stroking amongst critics going like, well, it must be good. What you want is it to be a moderate success, but a cult classic later on. You want it to have been dismissed by enough reviewers that people, when they rediscover it in a few years' time, will feel like they're doing it ironically, because that's real longevity. Yeah. I feel like they're showing Josie and the Pussycats at the Prince Charles Cinema every week.
Are they?
Yeah, anything that people think is kitsch, that people actually will be watching years later, as opposed to a movie that blows up really big in 1 year and then suddenly everyone just forgets.
Yeah.
You want a good, slow release of a cult classic, you know, something that does okay, limited release, but gets the right people talking. And then years later, you know, reunion tours, questions, that kind of thing.
One of my favorite slow burns is, if not my only one, really, because the first one that springs to mind is Gross Point Blank. But then Showgirls, I think, is it Showgirls?
Showgirls is in that category, yeah.
Because that Gross is Point tacky. Blank. That is tacky.
Showgirls, but to be honest, so many things that are tacky when they come out become beloved within 10 or 15 years because loads of people don't remember how tacky it was when it came out, or something that was panned for being so gauche.
Yeah.
Well, then in 10 years, what gauche is changes. Gross Point Blank is a great film. That's a real example of the 90s film formula of being like, Don't think too much about it. Just let's go. He's a hitman. Don't worry about the moral implications of that. Don't worry about rooting for a guy who kills people for a living. Just, it's a rom-com. What if a hitman fell in love? And Minnie Driver's here, and we love her because it's 1996.
And it's a coming of age film as well, because he goes back to school and he never really finished school. And so it's kind of like him completing his journey as an adult.
That movie could go in a very different direction. Hitman goes to his school reunion.
I mean,
Jesus.
It wouldn't just be like the French Franco-Belgian assassin who ends up in the incinerator at the end of the film. It could be all sorts of people who end up in that.
Yeah,
I think it's interesting, like that you say, that's a really good point about how what is gauche or what is kind of considered tacky changes. Because Showgirls was, I mean, it was. I remember, I think I saw some of it a while ago, but it's not great. But do you know what? It's funny. It's kind of funny, and it's not so sort of serious. And lack of CGI, very appealing. That's also very appealing.
That's also a great thing about loads of movies in the 80s and 90s is that, you know, no CGI. So the whole experience is a bit different because it's consistent.
Yeah. Would you CGI much in Astronaut? Or are you actually going to go into space?
I think if we're doing the Wes Anderson formula, as we talked about earlier, I think we'd have to do a good amount of physical effects.
Yeah.
Which would be fun to do if the budget allowed. I think we probably wouldn't be too ambitious on the old CGI front. I think I'd probably want to keep this to a nice 8-week shoot.
Nice.
And as a result, I think we'd be too constrained, unfortunately. No CGI. Maybe one inexplicable, costly scene that everyone's a bit like, that didn't need to be in it at all.
Again, that's a great thing just to drop in, pointlessly.
Yeah.
There's been an explosion at the dinosaur farm. What?
Yeah. And it is visually ambitious. Wow. You can see inside of its chest cavity. You can see all its dinosaur organs. The detail feels very irrelevant to our lives. Do you still want to be an astronaut? Still doing discus, huh?
So, great news, Rajiv. Astronaut has been made. It's in the can. It's ready to be released. It's the premiere. It's the premiere night. Where's the premiere taking place and who's invited?
I would like it to happen in a revolving restaurant. And then you get there and they actually, the only screen they have is like a small 10-inch TV that they have that is up above the bar. And so it's quite uncomfortable, but it's kind of cool. And if anything, and then that way, if people are bored with the movie or don't have a good view, they can be like, oh, we're in a revolving restaurant. That's nice.
Very thoughtful of you.
Yeah, because I feel like I got to go to a film premiere recently.
Oh, yeah.
And it was wicked. I mean, it is properly great.
Who was that? What was that? Was it Julian Casablancas getting you in again, was it? Or...
Oh, I wish. The man's not returning my calls. no, I got to go to the screening of Catherine Called Birdie, the new Lena Dunham film. Completely lucked into it. I think, I don't know, I got an email being like, do you want to go to this? And I was like, yeah, okay. And the thing is, because I had got booked in through my agent, I'd obviously gone onto a list of what, quote-unquote, talent. And I think effectively they're going, ooh, just in case this guy happens to be famous. So I ended up going straight up to the red carpet. All the photographers knew my name. They got all these pictures of me. And then after I was done, Lena Dunham went on. And I was thinking, we're not the same. She made the movie and Girls and a bunch of other big deal things. I'm just like some dude. But for a moment, they thought I was real.
Did you make Lena Dunham wait much? Were you there posing? Were you striking poses?
No, I couldn't possibly do that. I got in there, took a couple of photos, and I got out. That'll do something for. I was like running inside, trying to see what kind of free popcorn they've got.
Did you get that talk? You know, you spoke earlier about that tingle you got from going into the gig, having blagged your way in with the extra friend at the Casablancas band gig. When you're there, getting the photographer's attention and the flash bulbs are going off, did you have that sort of
a little less because you're on the red carpet with lots of other people. And if anything, you're like, well, I didn't work on this at all. So it's not my night. But with the getting in backstage, we can all enjoy that, you know, because that's being the greatest kind. You know, I'm just a punter at the show, but I'm so much more. And nobody else knows.
So who is coming to the premiere and where is it going to take place then? You've experienced the premiere.
I think this sort of this film has become sort of a real mishmash. It's a very odd, unusual movie. Hopefully, maybe it'll be beloved as one of those really strange films. It'll kind of be loved by people who like the weirder work of Christopher Guest, or people who David Cronenberg films, or people who like really bizarre movies. And so I think if that was the case, you know, it starts out as people watch it and they're like, it's weird. It's got this sort of sport motif at the start and loads of stuff about him being a British Asian. It's played by Will Poulter. And then, you know, it's about getting into uni, but then he drops out of uni to pursue sketch comedy. And at the end, he's an astronaut. What? And I think if that was the case, you'd want to have sort of semi-legendary stories about the premiere. So it takes place at a revolving restaurant.
Yeah.
And I think we'd get like a bunch of odd people hired to be there. So I think pairs of adult identical twins wearing matching suits. I think that's number one. I think celebrity lookalikes.
Oh, that's
really
gross.
Confused any photographers who are there. I'd be like, oh wait, Jack Nicholson? But it looks like Jack Nicholson from the 80s. And he's not getting too close. George Michael, what? And then they start to clock that these are all lookalikes.
This is a great idea.
Yeah, kind of, all of this stuff would really just to impress someone like Nathan Fielder.
Do you know as well though? It's a tenuous callback, but I'm going to make it. All the people you hired, celebrity lookalikes, they're stars. The film's called Astronaut. It's all coming together.
Yeah, and people will think, well, oh, it's about dreams and stuff. I mean, I think we've all seen adverts for kind of pixie dream movies. Like, I don't know, I never saw it, but Captain Fantastic or,
yes,
you know, and the poster's really colourful. It's got an odd name. Maybe people will see that and think, oh, that movie could be about anything. And they'll have such high hopes to see it that I've judged the book by its cover. And then they'll see the film and they'll go, very little substance. And I'll think, yeah, that's me.
Have you seen Captain Fantastic?
No.
Let me tell you, the poster does not sell what is actually in that film. What is actually in that film is at times absolutely heartbreaking and even disturbing at some points as well. Like there's a lot of references to Noam Chomsky, and a small child is given a compound bow as a present on Noam Chomsky's birthday. It's a very odd film given I saw the poster and I thought this is a kind of a Wes Anderson kind of like caper. It's full of sadness.
I think that's great. Think about it. Most of the time, I've really enjoyed a film has been when I didn't know anything about it or completely misunderstood what it was about.
Yeah.
And the surprise is really fun. I think more films should do that. They should completely go really rogue with the marketing.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to make any, you know, I don't know what this film's about at all. Oh, this film looks like it's going to be a very fun comedy. Just the most spine chilling horror you've ever seen. No jokes.
Famously, that was Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, I think. The marketing campaign for that, the trailer, again, didn't sell the film because it had Mr. Blue Sky being played as the music and it had lots of kind of like really cool visual imagery.
Oh.
And you're like, oh, wow, this is going to be really funny because it's Carey and Kate Winslet doing something a bit different and it looks like it's really fun. And of course, if you've seen Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, again, it's hard. It's really sad.
Yeah.
Like it's a really sad movie. It's not a caper.
Also, you can get away if you've got a non-linear film, the trailer won't reveal that because...
Yep.
People will just think, oh, we're just seeing bits from throughout the film. That's
yep.
like how all trailers work.
Yep, yep.
And then it's like, actually, no, that's the order.
That's a great... I don't know has a trailer ever done that? Because that is a great idea. And so who isn't invited to the premiere, Rajiv? Who's not coming? Why aren't they coming?
You know what? I'm a friendly guy. I don't have enemies. At least I don't think so. they don't tell me about it. So I think I'd like to invite, there's nobody I'd want to actively disinvite, but I think I'd probably keep going with the Nathan Fielder thing and like deliberately not invite a few key players. And I'd make it up to them. I think say Will Poulter and then a few of the other main cast, and I wouldn't invite them. And I would just maybe make up a bunch of different excuses as to why they weren't there. So people would be like, oh, Will Poulter's not here. And I go, oh, I'm so sorry, Will Poulter couldn't be here. He's currently... 70 feet below the surface of the earth, and then just not explain it or just tell people a different thing every time.
I mean,
that's the thing.
Is that to keep them off the press, stop them from doing any press? You don't want them to do any press
again to confuse. You'd have just people at the premiere going, what is this for? Who is this? by this point, all of the photographers are just like, he's misled us several times. There's all these adult identical twins here. I think, yeah, just something like that.
There we have it. Astronaut, starring Will Poulter, featuring running, discus, running with a discus, queuing for bread, a Wes Anderson filter, the Portuguese version of Lust for Life, Ferris Bueller, Julie Andrews, and a revolving restaurant. Rajiv Karia, congratulations on being greenlit.
Thank you so much. It's an honor. It's an honor to make this truly stuck in development hell for 5 years film.